Well, hello all. Welcome to the Vote Common Good Daily Podcast. It's Wednesday, the 21st of April, and joined with by Stephanie Spaulding, Dominique Gilliard. Normally we have Laura Truax, but we're having all kinds of technical difficulties today in our little system, and we can't seem to get all of us on. We're starting late. We all feel that frustration, and I'll tell you, nothing sort of matches like a metaphor like this, right? The system doesn't always work, and sometimes, you know, it does for a brief moment, but it still tells you that when the system doesn't work, it's maddening and frustrating. That's true in our broader society. That's true in our local context or churches or organizations. It's true in our computers. And around here, we try to encourage ourselves with a little bit of faith. And this being the day after the Derek Chauvin trial verdict of guilty, guilty, guilty came. And all three of us, I know we've been chatting while we're trying to get the technical pieces to work, have conflicted feelings about all of this. There's just a lot of different emotions that are running and racing. So we had a whole topic scheduled for today. Earth Day is tomorrow. We're going to talk about that, but we're going to do an abbreviated version and reflect on where we find ourselves now the best that we can. So hello, Stephanie. Hello, Dominique. Sorry, Laura, that you're not with us. Hi there.
Hi, and I am grateful that we are just working through the honesty, the authenticity of this moment and this day. And yes, technology seems to be working with us as well, reminding us that systems don't always work. I am Reverend Dr. Stephanie Rose Spaulding, based in Colorado Springs, pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church. And today is a hard day for us to be having conversations, but nevertheless, we persist. Dominique?
Yeah, good morning. Dominique Gilliard coming to you from right outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and serve as the Director of Racial Righteousness and Reconciliation for the Evangelical Covenant Church. And yeah, just continuing to sit with all the yesterday meant and all that surrounded yesterday that wasn't directly even about the verdict. The shooting that happened as the verdict was coming down in Columbus, Ohio, saw another really gruesome video that just exposes the problems of our system with two young boys just riding their bikes. And they get stopped by law enforcement who have guns pulled out on them, demanding them to get off their bikes onto the ground and ultimately to crawl towards them on the concrete, all because they just fit the description. Mm-hmm. And so I think about the trauma that these two young boys have and how this moment with law enforcement will be forever imprinted in their mind as they try to negotiate life as Black boys and ultimately Black men in this country. And so, you know, it's just all full circle, appreciating that there was some form of accountability that was passed down yesterday, but still knowing how inadequate the present system is and kind of not fully able to embrace what justice is in this present moment.
So. Yeah, I've really been struck by just thinking about all the layers and all the pieces that were exposed from the killing of George Floyd, from the responses, what that brought on, and then the verdict has the same thing, right? You start to realize that there's so many interlacing issues that are tied up in all of this. And I could feel it yesterday when I would hear people like want to use certain descriptions and not other ones, right? So our attorney general, Keith Ellison, was one of the first people that I saw that said, let's not call this justice yet because justice needs restoration. Let's call it accountability. And I remember sort of hearing that and thinking like, is this really the time to be distinguishing between accountability and justice? Like, is that a definition we're supposed to make? And then later in the night, I'm like, I'm really good point that he made. I'm glad that he made that point because, and then in the middle of the night, I woke up kind of still thinking about it and just wondering, you know, you start to realize in these moments of intensity, whether it's intensity of a wrong or an intensity of feeling that something was done the way that we wanted it to go, It also exposes all the tangled up pieces to all of this, you know? And I just keep thinking of these parables of Jesus, and Jesus has this one where he says, you know, the wheat and the tares, or the wheat and the weeds, they grow together and their roots get all connected, and you can't go ripping out some or you're going to rip them all out. I've never really understood what he is getting at with that teaching all that well, but it comes up fairly often. And it feels like this is one of those moments, right? We're all tangled up and we're trying to figure out and separate each of these pieces. And I was saying to my wife last night, like, I wonder what the people who don't think this was a good verdict are saying. Like, what I really couldn't even conjure up what they were saying. And then my wife, Shelly, took the remote of our television set and turned it over to Fox News, and oh boy, there we go. Okay. And I just kept saying, like, we got to turn this off. This is unbelievable. This whole other narrative that's rolling out there. And, you know, I don't know. I just felt myself wanting to look away from all of that and feeling the frustration. I know each of you have also had some moments where it's felt a bit like that. So.
Yeah, it's, I think for me, it's like all of the complexity and the interlockingness of who we are called to be in this world, not just being an African-American woman, but also being a pastor and public figure in the moment of this, having also been an activist and spent like countless hours, not just last summer, but, you know, beyond that, before that, doing this work. And so I still don't necessarily have words for all, you know, all the things. And that in and of itself is frustrating, right? Because I am, you know, I tend to pride myself on being a good and effective communicator, right? And like, I don't have the like all the words yet. And so yesterday, even before the verdict was announced, just in the announcing of there is a verdict is in, right? Like when we got that information that a verdict was in, I literally just had to stop doing everything, like all of the work. I contacted the other colleagues that, you know, I had meetings with. I could not go on with a normalized work day. Like it was not going to happen for me because my mind was already someplace else. My spirit was already someplace else. And the anxiety that began to form, even though logic would say, like for those who study criminal justice, and I was literally on my phone with a criminologist, right? I have a really good friend who is a renowned criminologist, logic would say the timing, 10 hours, the absoluteness, like there's no hung jury, there is a verdict, right? Like all of the logical things were in place to signal that some level of affirmation or conviction was present. But for me as a Black woman, it was like, this is still America. Like this is still the United States. And so as a person of faith, even being robbed of that potential to hope, right? Like that capacity to hope for justice in that sense, in that specific moment to happen, right? And then as the verdict comes out and I am watching, she could not even watch, right? Like I literally had to communicate to her what the verdict was. And as guilty, first charge, guilty, second charge, guilty, third charge, all of the emotions that come up and the crying, the tears, and then with her breaking down and the realization also of like the pressure valve being released, but it's still not being freeing. Because the immediate question is like, why do we have to go through such extremes just for a semblance of acknowledgement that Black life matters in this country? And then to have to deal with, and it's still not enough. Mm-hmm. And I know that Laura is not here with us this morning, but And I say this with all the love that I can still, you know, immediately the question came back to me from a few episodes ago when the question was raised, like, when is it going to be enough for Black people? And this was a moment like literally in my spirit. And I was just like, and this is why it's not ever going to be enough, because we have Micaiah, I believe, is her name, Bryant, who was just killed in Columbus, Ohio. Dante Wright has not even been buried yet. Adam Toledo. I'm like, just so many. Elijah McClain, Devon Bailey, and people whose names that we don't even know. And we are all hanging on by a thread, hoping that this one would stick.
Yeah.
And this one, when there are so many others for whom no indictments, no, you know, no trials even.
Yeah.
So.
And this is why it's so dangerous for folk to think about Black people as a monolith, because you saw a vast diversity of responses to the verdict yesterday, and they were all valid. And every person is 100% worthy and able to determine how they felt in that moment, given the weight of what we carry in our bodies as Black folk, as we sojourn in this country. So I saw some folk dancing in the streets. I saw some folks saying, like, this is just, this should have happened. Like, it's ridiculous that it took this long to even discern a verdict given the evidence that was presented in the video. So, I mean, the spectrum is huge, but this is why it's so dangerous to think about Black folk monolithically and say, like, there is only one proper response for Black people. And I think in light of what was going on, as you both kind of beautifully kind of articulated, I think for me, yeah, I get Fox News. I get people who are 100% going to try to analyze this from a political lens. I get all of the deflections and the defenses that you can put up, like folks saying, like, this wasn't about race, or, you know, from all the things. But when it happens in the church, when it's our people who are the ones who are the loudest deflectors, the ones who are the most, have their heels dug in the most, really trying to say, like, this is not the church's business. The church shouldn't be speaking about this. This has nothing to do with what we're called to be and pursue in the world. And when we critique faith leaders who are entrenched in this work, who are trying to be everyday peacemakers in the midst of conflict-ridden spaces. Like, the thing about the church's critique that really, like, kills me is you have Christians who will critique the movement and say, like, the movement is embodying, you know, anti-gospel things, is being destructive, is being whatever. And then you have Christian leaders out there who are out there actually trying to harness the righteous indignation in a positive way. And then folks are still critiquing that. It's just like, you can't have it both ways. Like, I mean, if either you want to, like, say, you want to critique this and you want people of faith out there actually in the midst, actually trying to shepherd this in a productive way, or you just, and so I think it's the critique across the board. It's kind of like, there's that t-shirt that talks about, like, you know, you get mad if we stand up, you get mad if we kneel, you get mad. And so it's just like, what is acceptable response for Christians who are trying to discern what it means to live faithfully in the midst of these unjust circumstances? Like, that's the thing that I think boggles my mind and really breaks my heart, because scripture is clear. Like, the world is paying attention to our witness. And, you know, I always go back to John 13:34 and 35, and it says that the world will know that you are my disciples by your love for one another. If you choose to love one another. And it's in these critical moments that I really think that the world really pays attention, and they are discerning what they believe about God through the witness of the church. And so I think these are really pivotal moments for us to really discern kind of the movement of the Spirit and what we're being called to.
Yeah. That's,
and I think the witness of the church is arrested. And I use that word very intentionally, arrested by the existence of white supremacy, right? By the existence of systems like this, because my very first tweet, my immediate response, and I talked a little about this with Doug yesterday, because we still have work to do, right? And the image and the passage that came back for me first was the Exodus and the Red Sea parting moment. And that stays with me a lot because of my relationship with Jewish community and Passover and my family that I do Seder with during Passover. And in their retelling of the narrative, when we get to the Red Sea moment, there is a reminder that as Pharaoh's army is being drowned and the Israelites are on the other side, that God reminds the Israelites, you don't get to rejoice at the loss of life and the destruction of Pharaoh and his army because they still belong to me. And so my first tweet was, imagine things being so depraved that you are blessing God that a man is being sent to prison. Because that's how depraved we have gotten in this world, right? That my witness is being faithfully on my knees, asking the Lord to convict another human being and to, you know, to halter whatever their life is, because we have to wrestle with the systems of the world that do not see the humanity and will not allow the humanity of Black and brown people in this country. So justice for me is like, we should never have to get to that place, yeah. Right? Like going through a trial, having to endure the imprisonment of somebody else's life, and I'm definitely not an advocate of the death penalty, but the genuine witness that I want to live out is that everybody's life is mattered, that we don't get to the place that we have to be asking God for this kind of resolution.
Yeah. Wow. I'm just reminded by how there's all these different systems at play. There's a judicial punitive punishment system, the court system, that's related to, but different than the policing system. So in this one case, the judicial system worked the way we wanted it to. The state of Minnesota brought a case. The jury was impaneled. The trial ran. All of that went the way that we would say this was the right actions. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the policing system is working right. I mean, you think about any complex ecosystem and it has multiple systems in it. Our world has multiple systems. So we could see the judicial system in one case working the way that it should. Doesn't mean all the cases do. And right. It certainly doesn't mean that the policing system works the way that it needs to. Or that then the criminal punishment side of the judicial system is going to work the way. So once someone's calling for justice, it gets really complicated. Right. And we're having to find ourselves in the midst of this struggle to recognize that we can see that one thing is a success, but that doesn't mean that anyone's satisfied or we don't work on the other systems or that other issues also don't matter. Right. And that's the kind of maturity that we all recognize that we need in our lives, and to have enough interrelated care, you know, to think about this in a way that matches the moment. I mean, I agree with both of you so much. If we We shall not be satisfied until we're not having trials of police officers using brutality against people. Not we will be satisfied when police use brutality and then they're convicted of crimes. That's not a that's not a goal. That shouldn't be our goal. The governor of Minnesota said, hey, we should see this as the floor, not the ceiling. Like this is our starting point, that killer cops are going to be removed from the force and punished with whatever punishment we have in this state. But that's not what we're going for. And that can feel to some people like it's a never-ending treadmill. It can feel to people like, well, we're not getting anywhere. It can feel to some people who had a lot riding on this case that their feelings of jubilation and satisfaction were not sufficient. And, you know, Dominique, I heard you say that to paint all Black people in the same space. Boy, that was true listening to the Floyd family yesterday, even to paint the entire Floyd family. If you listen to that very long and beautiful press experience that they had after the verdict, they were in different spaces on how they're responding and where they saw themselves and what's calling them forward. So we just begin to realize these categories of culture that we apply are not meant to be uniform. They're meant to alive in the many realities that are at play here. And I think that's part of the frustration, you know, is that people feel like, oh yeah, and then everything else still exists, you know. And at the same time, this was so enormously important that this jury did not have a hung jury or come back with innocent on any of
split or anything. Yeah. No, I think what happened yesterday was tremendously important. It was hopefully precedent setting, But at the same time, you know, folk who know me and follow my work know that I don't wish the criminal justice system mass incarceration on anybody. Chauvin, even our, you know, the officer who, I don't know if y'all saw the statement from him this week, the retired officer, Thomas Webster, who was part of the insurrection in January, he complained that he couldn't believe that they had him locked up with real criminals in the local jail. He was flabbergasted by the fact that he was locked up. But it goes to this deeper logic that, you know, is really at play. Even within this trial, there is this belief that the law does not equitably apply to certain people who are fighting a justice, righteous fight, who are true citizens, and they might do criminal activity, but it's for the good of the nation. And so therefore they should not be equated to these common criminals who are just, you know, making our societies unsafe places. But these are true patriots, true citizens who, while they might break the law, but they have the wisdom to discern when it is good for the good of all and good of country and good of the nation to do so. And so I think, you know, yesterday was an important statement, because I want to just flip it. Think about what the verdict would have said yesterday if it didn't come down the way that it did. It would have literally said that there is no way in which a Black person could be killed by law enforcement in which there is any form of accountability for. I mean, that is probably one of the most, I mean, outside of Rodney King, which was just as blatant and just as, I don't know how you can sit there and see a life be taken in that fashion and form and say that there can't be any accountability. If they would have came down with a different verdict yesterday, I would have feared what it meant for Black people in this country. Because there would be, literally it would say that law enforcement is above the law when it comes to any time they choose to take the life of a Black person. Yeah. And I mean, I'll kick it to Stephanie with this, but that would have left me speechless.
Yes. And it's not ahistorical, right? That was the actual language of Dred Scott, right? Like that was the decision. When we came to Plessy versus Ferguson, right? Like that, again, there are no rights that a Black person and in that moment of Dred Scott, it wasn't even a person. There are no rights that these Black bodies have that a white man must acknowledge. Like, that is law, like, in terms of the history of law in the United States. And so for me, I feel in a lot of ways that, yes, we have come to this moment of redressing the history, or we have come to the opportunity of a moment to redress what has historically been so ingrained, not just culturally and psychologically, but legally in the United States, where there is a different set of rules for Black and brown bodies in this country. And I would have been definitely feeling a lot differently, to echo what Dominic said. The level of fear that would have arisen in me had the verdict been different yesterday would like, I would not have words for it. But that doesn't mean, and I'm trying to be as careful with my words right now, that doesn't mean that anxiety is still not there, right? Yeah. There will be repercussions. There will be repercussions, because all of the fodder is there for the growing concerns of Christian nationalists and Blue Lives Matter and all of these other people in opposition to what happened on yesterday. And then the other piece of that is, look what it took just to get to this place, right? It took a 17-year-old child having the wherewithal to stand there fastidiously and to record the murder of another human being. It took a 9-year-old having the courage to overcome trauma to testify in a court in front of all these people about what she witnessed. It took a mass global movement for us to articulate and to say out loud what we saw with our own eyes, right? Like, it took so much just to get this verdict, that when we look at the myriad of other cases out there, and I do hope that it sets a precedent, but it is a horrible precedent to set if it must take that much to get these kinds of convictions, and to also get us to the place to acknowledge that policing in this country is a failed system that must be deconstructed, and the culture of white supremacy rooted out. The cost of it, and this is like the real Christian question, right? The cost of what it takes to get to the salvific moment, right? When we are looking at Christ being beaten with cat of nine tails, being like tortured for days, and having to carry his own cross up a hill, like, the cost of it is so much that I don't believe humanity can continue to bear it.
Yeah, I think about all the people that were involved in this, as you say, Stephanie, so well, that it took, you know, Darnella, who shot the video, and then, as you might know, then she didn't know what to do with the video. So she sent it to Nikema Levy-Armstrong, who's an activist here in Minnesota. And then Nikema Levy-Armstrong, who had been protesting the police and therefore had a relationship with the police chief the night George Floyd was murdered, called the police chief and said, was there a murder on 38th in Chicago? And the police chief got back to her and said, no, I just read the report. And it was a medical incident that someone died, you know, when the police... And if you read the report yesterday, it's out on Twitter. I put it on my Twitter account, Padgett on Twitter. It's the statement that the police put in the record that basically said, we came, we put a man in handcuffs. He had a medical condition. We called an ambulance. He died at the hospital. That was the official statement. And Nakima Levy Armstrong said, I have a video showing that that's not the case. And then that video is what finally went out. So in one sense, the judicial system worked once all that was in place. But it was a 16-year-old, 17-year-old girl, and it was a community activist, and it was a police chief who would listen to that person. And then it was Keith Ellison, the Attorney General of Minnesota. And I just learned yesterday, and I didn't know this, that Derek Chauvin had, 3 days after the murder, had tried to strike a plea deal to plead guilty to third-degree murder. I don't know if you guys knew that. I didn't know that. And William Barr, Attorney General William Barr, denied that plea because Chauvin had negotiated that he wanted it to be a plea deal that would put him into federal prison and not have civil rights charges brought against him. And William Barr, of all people, said, no way. We're going to give you a third degree only. We're going to let, you know, the state of Minnesota take on this case. Chauvin's own statement was that he believed the video footage was so devastating that he was going to be found guilty. So this entire time, he knew he was guilty. But then we go through all of this work to be sure that the judicial system can respond. And that took people all along the way. And look, we do need laws that are going to be put in place, and we need to have new procedures put in place. And then you have to have people who will follow those laws, follow those procedures, and then go above and beyond them when they have to. Like, be the person that records the video and sends it, and be the activist that calls the police, and be the police chief that listens and becomes the attorney general that says no to a plea deal, and then becomes the attorney general that spends millions of dollars to put together a case. And we shouldn't have to do this, because it happens 1,000 times a year in this country that police kill people. The epidemic of police killing people. I know more people die in car accidents. Yeah, but we don't trust that our cars are supposed to keep us safe. We just hope the seatbelt works. But we do trust that the power of the government will not be out killing people and disproportionately killing black and brown people outside of anything that's reasonable to the number of those people in a population. So all of this systemic stuff involves so much.
I would say we might not trust, but we hope. Yeah. And I would say, you know, three things real quick. One, when you talked about kind of the initial report, we must also very clearly remember that initially the police said that Alan Toledo didn't have his hands up and that he had a weapon. So, like, I mean, the initial reporting of the institution has lost all its credibility. And so we need to be clear about that. And Stephanie, you were making some really good points. And I think one, when you talked about the international pressure that came from this case, it brought me back to the civil rights movement. And it wasn't really until you saw little kids getting bitten by dogs on the front page of the newspaper, and you saw the international pressure get involved, that the U.S. finally did what it needed to do and actually passed the legislation that it needed to pass, that it was resisting passing until there was this external pressure. And I think in that, we need to realize that we always are tempted. The empire tries to tempt us to not believe in the power of the people. Yeah. But when we collectively mobilize and we commit ourselves to seeking justice in the face of injustice, we have the power to cultivate change. But the question is, do we have the political will and the wherewithal to stick with it, to actually bring it to fruition? And then lastly, when you were talking, there was one last thing. I had three. I will come back to it. It was something else you had said earlier. I don't want to take the time, so I'll wait. Right. And I'll come back when it comes to me.
You're the best. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we thank those who are watching online and tuning in, and just want to say again, this is not an easy day. This will not be an easy week or season for a lot of people. So be careful with yourselves and be mindful and compassionate, empathetic with others as we are navigating, again, the variety, the diversity of responses and reactions. Please, I encourage you to not make it the responsibility of your Black and brown friends to bear your emotional labor this week and in this season. So again, be really careful with yourself. Know what your triggers are and have a plan, because it is not a matter of if folks will be triggered. It is a matter of when. Yeah. And so know that about yourself, be aware of that about yourself, and do the things that are necessary to do the care work that you need.
I remembered the last thing I was going to say. It was about the fact that, you know, the only reason why this verdict was able to be reached in the way that it was is because we have the video evidence. If you think about our criminal justice system, depart from cell phone video footage and body cam evidence, it would be fundamentally different than what we currently have. It's still inadequate. It's still not enough. There's still videos where we see murder with our own eyes and the verdict comes out differently. But I want you to think about the fact that since Black people in this country were legally no longer considered property, we have had incidents like this with law enforcement and vigilantes where we have told a communal narrative. We have borne witness to murder and life being mercilessly taken. And we have gone before juries that were not of our peers up until the 60s. And then we went in front of juries that were made of our peers, and we have continuously been denied justice. And so what I want people to understand is that this is not a new reality. This is something, if we want to be generous, since 1865, we have been struggling with and advocating for, and we have not been believed. And we are finally seeing that there is proof in the pudding, and that we are not people who are just making up stories about being assaulted and our lives being violated, but there is actually this long legacy of receipts that we're trying to bring to the table when we're having these conversations about criminal justice reform, about judicial accountability, about policing. This is something that has been and continues to be a problem. And the only reason why we're starting to see incremental change is now that we have documented video evidence that the world can see.
And we also, I think what gets lost too in the, well, it's 24 hours, not even 24 hours, is the all of that happened, and it was this particular kind of jury that was literally a diverse jury that was able to hear, even with their own, you know, articulated perspectives around Black lives and police accountability and things of that nature. It was a particular kind of jury. And so the other piece that I want to encourage in this process is we have to stop avoiding jury duty and recognize, like, that is part of having a judicial system that functions at least adequately. And then we also need to look legislatively. Much of the legislative work that we want to happen cannot happen because we have a Senate that is not working. We have a Senate that refuses to actually govern and pass legislation. We have put forth almost 200 bills in the history since 1865 of anti-lynching bills that have never passed both the House and the Senate because we have a Senate that just will not get rid of the filibuster and they will not take a vote. And so again, as we think about what justice looks like in a overall work of valuing people's life in this country, we have to know that all of those pieces of the puzzle need to be aligned so that we don't get to a place where conviction is misunderstood as justice, when it is really just accountability.
Well, boy, I'll tell you, I am so appreciative of both of you, of your contributions to these conversations, over all the work that you both do, to me personally, to those who participate in this podcast and live stream. Thinking about Laura, who couldn't get on today, I know she would feel very much the same, and so appreciative for all of this. So feels like it's going to be.
As we sign off, Doug, I just want to like dovetail this. So as we kind of affirm the verdict from yesterday, let's also remember that the officer who killed Jacob Blake returned to work this week with no charges. And so just to give a kind of mirroring of the tension that we live in as we have this conversation.
Yeah, that's right. And look, these reminders are crucial, right? We all know things. And we have to open our mouths, we have to open our eyes, we have to open our ears, we have to say and to share the things that we know. And, you know, sometimes those reminders are welcomed by people. And sometimes those kinds of reminders are difficult to hear. You know, it's like getting a payment reminder that you didn't want to receive, that there was something owed, you know. And these are all really important. And I'll say to the, you know, the people who are in the white community in this country, ask questions to your friends of color about how they're doing. Don't presume that this is that you know how they're feeling about a response like this. Ask and inquire. And know that different people are going to be responding differently. And depends on what time of the day, frankly, that you're thinking about them. I have, like you, Stephanie, I had a fitful night's sleep last night and, you know, was dreaming about snakes coming out of my ceiling. And everybody's going to have their own way and their own time. This is bringing up a lot of issues. This country lives in collective trauma, and trauma is throughout our system, throughout the bodies of people in this country, especially people of black and brown bodies have a particular kind of trauma. And all of us who understand what trauma is know that it manifests itself in different places and different locations in our lives. And so inquiring of one another about how we are, it can be sort of a casual greeting, hey, how you doing? And it can also be when you're really going to engage in an issue like this, I would suggest really starting with the question of how is someone right now in this moment? To know that you have your own experience and people have their own, and that's what we need to listen to for and with one another. And if you're in communities of faith that are struggling with this, and I know there are, Dominic, you brought it up at the beginning, there's people in different traditions and different church traditions that they don't know how to talk about this, and they're conflicted and concerned and worried. And just because you're in a church, just because you're a person of faith, just because you walk close to Jesus doesn't mean you understand what's going on. If the gospel story tells us anything, those who walk closely with Jesus involve a betrayer who turns, sells Jesus out. It's a denier who takes out a sword and cuts a man's face because he thought that this should be an armed insurrection as opposed to rebellion against violence. So people even very close, the closest of disciples, have these stories wrong. So please do not any of us think that our participation in the kingdom of God or in a community of faith means we see the world the way that we ought to see it. We still require all of us, it still requires us to have moment after moment where our eyes are opened. And we're all walking this path, and it's an unclear path step by step. So Stephanie, Dominic, either of you have a final comment you'd like to make before we do our sign-offs?
Be well today.
Yeah, I just appreciate the participants' interaction in the thread and had some really good comments affirming that they just appreciated the vulnerability and the transparency and the openness in which we share. And as we move forward and we try to make this world a more just nation and pursue the common good, this is what we're going to have to do. We're going to have real, open, raw conversations with one another. We're going to have to identify one another's blind spots, and we're going to have to speak truth and love and bear with one another. But we got to stay at the table. And I think, you know, our ability to stay at the table at this moment in time is one of the ways in which I think the world really does start to identify us as followers of Christ, because in the midst of the broken community and that's so normative around the country, if we can be people who can stay at the table together and actually really get into the muck and the mire and actually start to enter into confession, lament, and repentance, and actually try to discern a more faithful way together of kind of pursuing life together, I think the world will really start to identify that there's something distinctive about who and whose we are. And so I think it's a beautiful opportunity right now for us to do that.
Thank you all. We'll join you tomorrow if you want to join us tomorrow, 10 a.m. Central Time, and all the other days. So thanks, Stephanie. Thanks, Dominique.